With that, I'm going to go ahead and move on and introduce our first lecturer. Tim Muris is a foundation professor of law here at the Antonin Scalia Law School. He is one of the leading, arguably the leading expert in this field of consumer protection. From 2000 to 2004, he served as chairman of the Federal Trade Commission, but he had spent several stints at the FTC previously in his career in a variety of different positions, including both as the director of the Bureau of Competition, which is the division that deals with antitrust and competition matters, and the Bureau of Consumer Protection. He also spent some time at the Office of Management and Budget, and he practiced law at a couple of different firms here in Washington, D.C. With that, I'm going to ask you to help me welcome Professor Tim Muris to the stage.
Well, thank you, Greg. Let me tell you a little bit more about myself. I was born in Stark County, Ohio, where the Pro Football Hall of Fame is. I was born in Maslin. The Pro Football Hall of Fame is in Canton, and every year my two sons and brother and I, who I'm about to meet, my brother and younger son love to fish. God knows why I'm doing this, but we're going on the Canada Minnesota border and fish for the next few days. And the weather, as you can imagine, at this time of year, it's great fishing, but it's not going to be warm. Coming from Stark County, I'm a big sports fan. My dad played on the first team. My dad's long dead. He played on the first team. Paul Brown, who is the inventor of modern, according to Bill Belichick, the inventor of modern pro football. My dad played on the first team. Paul Brown coached at Maslin Washington High School in the early 1930s. But we moved to San Diego when I was in seventh grade, which is everything you've ever heard. I grew up in Southern California in the late 60s, early 70s, and everything you've ever heard about California in that time is true. Ironically, I've always been a contrarian, and one of the contrarian aspects of me is I was anti-drug, so I never got involved in the drug culture, which was rampant and growing at that time. I went to college in Southern California, undergrad at San Diego State, law school at UCLA, went to the first of six jobs in the federal government right out of law school at the Federal Trade Commission, four jobs at the FTC. So I am comfortable with, like government work, have a lot of admiration for people that work in the government. And four of those jobs were at the Federal Trade Commission, where I know a lot of you work for the state government, where we had great partnerships with the states. And one of the areas I'm going to talk about today was a fraud program, and the FTC and the states and other agencies have brought thousands of cases involving fraudsters. Well, what I want to talk about today, and it reminds me of my affinity for sports. When I first started this area, I wasn't exactly sure what I was getting into, and it reminded me of there's this famous baseball player who became known more as a funny kind of philosopher named Yogi Berra, and he was the guy who was famous for saying crazy things like this restaurant is so crowded nobody goes there anymore, and when you come to a fork in the road, take it, and things like that. But my favorite story about Yogi was he went to parochial school in St. Louis, where he grew up, and his given name was Lawrence, and the nuns were berating him because he wasn't a very good student. And they finally said, "Lawrence, don't you know anything?" And he looked back at them and he said, "I don't even suspect anything." So early on, that's the way I felt about a lot of this. But having thought about these issues for a long time, I've come up with a way that that fits with my market-oriented philosophy and fits government agencies into that philosophy. And the periods at which I was at the FTC were very aggressive law enforcement, but consistent with that. When I was, if you look at FTC antitrust enforcement, for example, there are two peaks in non-merger enforcement in the last 40 years, both affiliated with when I was there. We created the fraud program, which I'm going to talk about. We were known, our 15 minutes of fame, Howard Beals. When I talk about consumer protection, Howard Beals is coming later. Howard's lips are moving somewhere. Howard and I first started working together in 1981, and he's speaking to you later today. But we created the National Do Not Call Registry, which is now under siege because of robocalls. Robocalls are like spam, and the solution to spam was technological, and I think that will be the solution to robocalls. And the phone companies and the FCC are now actually working on a way that that they can block robocalls the same way that spam is blocked. So anyway, what I'm going to talk about is something called the three-legged stool. And we live in a market economy, so-called free enterprise and open markets. But it's not anarchy. It's not a system without rules. If you grow up in the law and economics world, like I did as a law professor, first as a contracts and antitrust professor, you obviously understand the benefits of rules. I often do consulting. And it's funny, people will come to me with big antitrust problems, and occasionally I'll say that's a contract law issue, like an offer and acceptance. You know, somebody will have a big billion-dollar problem, and I say, well, that's just an offer and acceptance problem. So the contract law stuff that we all took in first year still comes in handy. This legal framework, which I'm going to talk about, includes these two areas that I've worked in my whole professional life, been anchored by my association with the FTC in particular, which is consumer protection and competition laws. I'm obviously going to emphasize the consumer protection part here today. So I like to think of it as a three-legged stool. Todd Zwicky, who's going to talk to you later, is the one who gave us this. You know, we used to talk about it, this, you know, in terms of these three things, and Todd gave us the metaphor. The first two legs are the market economy, which provides competition. I'm going to talk about each leg individually, but just ticking them off here. The second are those legal. There's Todd just walked in. I just said good things about you, Todd. The second leg is those common law areas that we learned in the first year, contract, property, other private law areas that focus on the relative rights of parties when they interact. But just as a stool is unstable with only two legs, we need a third leg, and that third leg is government enforcement agencies. And I'm going to talk about that using fraud as an illustration. There are lots of other areas. We could walk through this whole thing in terms of competition. In the competition area, price fixing is the analog to fraud. Now, the first leg I mentioned was the market and competition. That obviously disciplines sellers. Customers can vote with their feet and wallets. I had a car die recently and was disappointed with one car dealer and just walked across the street to another. Here's another FTC guy, Alden Abbott, just walked in. Alden and I go back a long way as well. I'm just telling people how old we are, Alden. So, obviously, that's a major benefit of markets. And, you know, buying a car is, you go along Route 7 here, and all the car dealers are lined up along Route 7 outside the so-called Beltway. Quite convenient and easy way to shop. Even if you buy something infrequently, car is a good example, you can obtain all kinds of information on the internet. You can buy books. There are just all sorts of services to provide information. Fraud, and remember the illustration is about fraud. Fraudsters don't care about repeat business. They don't care about what Consumer Reports says about them. And that limits the ability of this first leg to discipline them. Second leg are these private legal rights that I mentioned, property, contract, tort law in particular, that can overcome or mitigate some of the problems that first leg cannot prevent. People will offer you contractual provisions, and I give some examples here, warranties, money-back guarantees. They can be enforced in court. But litigation over low-value transactions is often not feasible, even as a class action, although class actions definitely have their place. But even when the litigation system can work, a small claims court or a class action, or if it's enough money for you to, you know, go into court yourself, threaten, whatever, with fraud, the money just may be gone. The fraudster, if they're clever, they take the money, you know, they lie to you, they take the money, they're not around, you can't find them. Even if you can find them, they've spent the money, they've taken it overseas. So the first two legs don't work against fraud. Now, government enforcement agencies can overcome the weakness of the first two legs and support the market economy. They can combat fraud with modern tools. And this is an important, this is worth a couple minutes to talk about. The history of the FTC is quite, the FTC was created in 1914. And we wrote a book, several of us, published in 1981 by Cambridge University Press. And when doing the research for that book, there were all of these symposia about the FTC, and all of them this agency had a lot of promise, but it failed. And in 1969, there was a Nader report, then followed by a ABA report that President Nixon asked the ABA to do. And the ABA report said, this is it. This should be the last time. The agency either reforms or it should be abolished. Somebody else should do those useful things. And one of the things they recommended is that the FTC go after what they called ghetto fraud. But the problem was, at the time, if you think about fraudsters, there are two things you can do to go after the fraudsters. Remember, they don't pay attention to those first two legs. They don't pay attention to the market competition, to market signals, and you can't sue them as a private party. What you could do is put them in jail, or if you can take their money away from them, that would be effective as well. The problem is, in 1970, the FTC didn't have the tools to take their money away from them. So we sat down. I was director of the Bureau of Consumer Protection. I wasn't very old then. How old was I? I was 31. And we wanted the FTC in the 1970s, and I'll talk about this a little later, look like the CFPB today. The FTC's view was that the market economy was a failure and we needed to rewrite the rules. So the FTC had proposed literally a few dozen rules to rewrite major sections of the economy. I wrote an article in 1982 called Rules Without Reason, which was an attack on the FTC's 1970s rulemaking effort. And after the election, we said we want to move the FTC in a new direction and we wanted fraud to be the mainstay, but how did we go after it? Well, in 1973, Congress passed something called 13B, which is now under assault. But in 13B, the FTC received the power to have a permanent injunction. The power of permanent injunction includes, in certain cases, equitable ancillary relief. In 1975, the commission received the power to get monetary relief in certain circumstances, but only after it had filed an administrative action. That administrative action wouldn't work against a fraudster because the money would be gone. So what we did is we turned to 13B, and I mentioned in that second bullet up there, asset freezes. And this developed over the decades, convinced eight circuits that the FTC, under an appropriate showing, with a fraudster, could get, and again, there were lots of cases partnered with states and local officials, could get an ex parte order freezing assets. And that became the basis of what became known as the 13B fraud program. And growing, it became successful beyond our wildest dreams. The first case involved something called the International Diamond, and it returned virtually all of the money, which was quite surprising. I think since it had never been done before, the fraudster had no idea that the FTC was out there. It was unusual historically to return all of the money. But the FTC has returned billions of dollars over the years. We even, when I was chairman, sued, if you guys remember, Ms. Cleo. Surprisingly, she didn't see it coming. And it grew through each chairmanship. Now, there's a Seventh Circuit case that has overturned a very recent, about a month ago, has said the FTC doesn't have this power. I think the case is wrong, although I also think in an article Howard and I wrote that the FTC is wrong to argue that it can use this authority beyond fraud, but it's a long article in the Antitrust Law Journal. It's kind of beyond our scope here. But that is a very big deal, that Seventh Circuit case, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But back to resetting the point of this discussion today is we've got these three legs. We've got the market and the competition, and that's the basic protection of consumers. Markets need rules. We've got the common law, which provides lots of rules. Those rules can be enforced by lawyers. When they can't be enforced by lawyers, there's a role for agencies. Now, and the agencies, one of their main jobs is to enforce the common law. I also think there are roles for agencies to provide rules in certain cases. For example, let me give you three good examples of what rules that I think the FTC has provided. One is something called the mail order rule. At common law, if someone promises to deliver you you order something via mail or now more likely via the internet, and there's not a term of delivery or a specified term of delivery. By common law, that would delivery has to be in a reasonable time. Well, the FTC defined the reasonable time in the mail order rule back in the, you know, this was back in the day, the reasonable time was 30 days. That made sense. The cooling off rule was another one that made sense. For door-to-door sales, which is not the normal way in which people particularly, again, back in the day, purchase goods, for door-to-door sales where they weren't in their normal market setting, the FTC developed a cooling off period. The do not call rule, I thought, was another good example. When we, Howard and I and others, looked at the at privacy 15 years ago, people wanted to argue that the big issue in privacy was control over your information, notice and choice on the internet. Well, we define privacy issues. This is an article we wrote in the Chicago Law Review, published in 2005. We thought that when you ask consumers, when you ask Americans, are you concerned about privacy? And they would say, of course they would say yes. Privacy is what economists call a normal good, which means that more privacy is better than less. But when they said they were concerned about privacy, what that meant to most people is they were afraid about the security of their data on the internet and in other places. They were concerned about misuses of their data. That was the main thing that bothered consumers in practice. And so so we turned to developing a privacy program that was based on misuse of data. We developed the FTC's information security program, where the FTC has brought numerous cases where information security has been lax. And one area where information, where people felt that they were, their information was misused and they were injured, was just the hassle from interruption of their dinner hour. And hence we developed this very simple do not call rule. Now, when we did it, we had no money and no authority, but I took the attitude, if we build it, they will come. So we got the authority and we got the money. And it was interesting. A judge struck it down on a Wednesday and Congress gave us the authority on a Thursday. So it was an unusually quick congressional reaction. So there is a, I think, an active role for an agency like the FTC, but it's a role that fits within these other legs. It's not a role where it's a role where the FTC is an umpire. It's not the star player. So just talk for a second about competition agencies. Competition agencies, and the FTC is both, they reinforce the two legs, just like the consumer protection side does. And one of the nice things that that you have when you put an agency together with both competition and consumer protection, and there are many, many agencies around the world that do that, I think the two sides are reinforcing. I think the benefits of competition help people who do consumer protection because I think it reinforces the idea of the three legs. And I quite frankly, in my experience, I wouldn't say this in a room of competition people, but consumer protection people in many ways are better investigators than competition people. And I found that that the investigative tools of consumer protection people, I've tried to use those to help on the competition side. There's also something that's in this last bullet, which I thought was very important with the FTC. There's something that I call cheap exclusion, which is a term that some of our colleagues at the FTC invented. In antitrust law, there's a long history of so-called predatory pricing. And the problem with predatory pricing theory is it's an expensive way to drive out your competitors. And it's particularly expensive because it costs a lot of money to drive them out. And and once you drive them out, unless there are real entry barriers, other people can enter. And therefore it's expensive exclusion. Cheap exclusion, there's a very time-honored way to exclude competition, and that's to get the government to do it. And that's a very traditional, time-honored way in the United States and all throughout the world, get the government to limit competition. Adam Smith said that that businessmen love to restrict competition, and businessmen love to get the government to restrict competition. So there are two doctrines in antitrust law that protect the rights of businessmen to use the government. One's called the Norr-Pennington Doctrine, by which you have a First Amendment right to petition the government. The other is called the state action doctrine, by which under certain circumstances the state can protect anti-competitive activity regardless of the federal antitrust laws. Both of those have been, we thought, were interpreted too broadly. And the FTC, over the decades, under both Republicans and Democrats, has been successful in getting the Supreme Court to narrow the interpretation of the state action doctrine, and has had some success with the lower courts under Norr-Pennington. And one of the reasons there were those two spikes that I mentioned when I was associated with antitrust law was bringing these so-called cheap exclusion cases. Okay. Now, some of this, let me talk for the next few minutes, and I've already highlighted this. There's a competing vision, and the competing vision is returned. I have these boxes in my basement, which I thought were of only historical interest. And the boxes in my basement were of the 1970s. They're of my whole career, but a lot of them are of the 1970s. And the 1970s has returned big time. In antitrust, it's returned with the progressives and those on the left and the right who want to break up the big tech companies. I actually think that there are some issues on the big tech companies, but I don't think the big tech companies are uniform. If you look at so-called GAFA, Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Apple, they are significantly different in their market share and their approaches, and I think that although some of them I think have serious antitrust problems, the idea that all of them have created problems and should be broken up, I think is a return to the biggest bad days of the 70s. On the consumer protection side, which is what this talks about, what I referenced before, is the FTC in the 70s tried all of these rules. It was called the second most powerful legislature in Washington. That surely is not an appropriate role, whatever you think, for five unelected bureaucrats. And these rules were market supplanting. The FTC went in industry after industry, and it tried to change the way the industry worked. And that vision collapsed in the face of bipartisan congressional criticism, and the modern paradigm that we talked about arose in its place. It also, the few rules that got to court, most of them lost. Now, the modern CFPB, the Elizabeth Warren version, is an independent agency within an independent agency with a single director and a guaranteed budget drawn directly from the Federal Reserve's operating revenues. In other words, it's not trying to be the second most powerful legislature with five unelected bureaucrats. It's one unelected bureaucrat with enormous power. And that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And I think ultimately Whatever happens, whoever wins, the CFPB's power is going to run into a lot of challenges. Already, within what the CFPB did in the banking industry, and we've got one of the world's leading experts back there, Professor Zwicky, they've had a serious impact on the recovery of the housing market. Janet Yellen, the Obama head of the Federal Reserve, was very critical of is one of the sources of the second bullet, was very critical of CFPB rules. And if you look at Elizabeth Warren's vision, she thought that the market didn't work. She thought that the payment card companies, for example, were seriously harming companies, and it's a vision that is antithetical to the vision that's espoused in these slides. Now, the FTC, if you contrast the law that the FTC applies and the law of the CFPB, that's another important area. The FTC's law is unfair or deceptive practices. And after a lot of struggle, those terms, although they're broad, have definitions and a fairly substantial case law. The CFPB has taken those two terms but added a new term, abusive. And abusive is open-ended the way the FTC unfairness used to be open-ended. The FTC's 1964 definition of unfairness, which was written, believe it or not, by Dick Posner when he was a law clerk what's called an attorney advisor to Commissioner Phil Ellman, provided something that looks like modern CFPB abuse. And that got the FTC into the trouble that was discussed in the previous slide. And so I think there's a difference in that article that Howard and I wrote. I think the difference is explained in the third bullet between an agency that fits into the three-legged stool that tries to reinforce the market and provide rules for a market that it thinks works, and an agency that believes there's something fundamentally wrong with the market.